Plan, a different plan, inclusive plan. And the it seems like it was just doing not coming up to some things.
Should we start? Or should we wait for, do you know if any of your friends are still coming?
Maybe some people.
Maybe some people? Okay, maybe. Then maybe we'll see. Maybe they're all stuck on the screen face.
There's no that's not weird. You're saying maybe don't plan versus
Basically, if we force an influence into those actions, maybe insane. Like you're a you basically only that. So you're planning to see it.
So yeah.
That's I think you're measuring by their it's sufficient for an answer. So yeah, today I will be taking the class. Fortunately, David, or yeah, David needs to attend a conference, so he couldn't join in person. Yeah, so yeah, I'm taking the class, and the topic, as you know, is circuits. Try to understand and find a few some language model specifically. So let's get started. Okay, so let's start with some history because I like history. I think David mentioned about this paper a few weeks back. This is like the original back propagation paper from 1986, I guess. In this paper, Rumelhard and Hinton basically proposed back propagation. And they not only proposed back propagation, they also reverse engineered all the weights of the neural network that they trained using the back propagation on a data set, which is something like a family tree prediction kind of a data set. And if you read that paper, at the end of that paper, what are the argument they are that they are making is something like back propagation is not crazy. It is actually learning genuine algorithm which seems sensible to us. It can learn symmetry. That's why we should be using back propagation. It's not like some crazy algorithm. But then I think over the time we almost forgot about this aspect of back propagation, that it can actually learn genuine algorithms and representation, and we focus primarily on scaling things up. But eventually, I think people started thinking about that question again, something like 30 years later, when Chris Hollah and their team at OpenAI started asking the same question. If we can reverse engineer this huge models that we are able to train now, can we understand the features and the connections and the subnetworks within those networks? Yeah, so this was, I think, the first blog post within their circuit threads, where they, I think, analyzed Inception. Inception model to understand how is it able to do so well. And they found various kinds of features. And they showed that I think the earlier layers learn shallow features, whereas the later layers learn more high-level features. But in addition to those features, they actually started talking about subnetworks as well. So I think that the question that they were interested was, Okay, so we know that these features, the shallow features, are in the earlier layers and more complex features are in the later layers. So can we understand what is the relation between that? How the shallow features are actually getting transformed into more complex features? So that was their underlying question, and so that's why they started to look into the connections or the weights of the models as well. And they did some analysis, which is not super important, but the main point here is, I think this was, I would say, the sort of like the first paper in the modern era which started talking about subnetwork and circuits.
Is there any specific reason why they have observed that final layers have more learn more complex features than initial layers learn more shallow features? Like it could be other way around, or it could be a mix of layers. Because at the end, when we backprop those losses, they should be uniformly distributed or not.
That's a question. Decent question, but it's not super relevant to our discussion, I would say. But I think the answer to that would be, since the model needs to learn a lot of things, it is actually trying to encode common features. I mean, that would be my intuition. It's not like I have done experiments on that, but my intuition would be, since the model needs to do a lot of things, it would probably learn to do simple things, which is sort of common across a bunch of tasks in the earlier ones, and get more specialized into the later layers. That could be one argument. Other argument could be, maybe you need more layers just to get more complex features. That's why you get more complex features into the later layers. But that's okay. My reason to bring out this paper was just to share that this was, I think, the paper which sort of started the using the term concepts in the interpretability space. Sorry, I said concept. I meant circuit. Even though the term circuit has been used in neuroscience for quite some time, even in electrical engineering. In fact, interestingly, if you go out of that door, which he just opened now, you will see a notice board. There is a pamphlet. There is a poster for some kind of workshop. I think it's from some electrical engineering undergrads kind of workshop, where they have a topic for a single for one of the days as circuit simulation. So my point is, circuit is a common term across a bunch of other disciplines as well. It's not like we just invented the term, but I think this was the first paper we started using the term in the interpretability space. Okay, so that was the historical context, but now coming into like more specifics, what exactly I mean by circuit. So imagine this is your transformer architecture. You all know the transformer architecture. Now think of this architecture as a computational graph, where the nodes of the graph are basically your model component, and the weights connecting them is basically the edges in a computational graph. So if you imagine that, then what I mean by a circuit is basically a subgraph of that computational graph, which connects the inputs to the final logics. That's it. It is just a set of components which are interconnected with each other and have a direct passage from the inputs to the final output. That's what I mean by circuit. Okay.
So here in that in this diagram is the gray stuff, the notation you're using to indicate it's in the circuit, or is the gray stuff for the stuff that's not in the circuit?
Not in this. Maybe I should. Yeah.
Oh,
Gray
so
stuff.
the yellow stuff is the stuff that's in the circuit for you?
Yes.
Okay, cool. Just learning your diagram, that's all.
Yeah, maybe I should be more explicit. But
Oh,
yeah.
Jasmine had a question, is that right?
Yeah, but I think she's online. Yeah,
Yeah.
she's on it. Yeah.
Sorry. Actually, my voice is like really gone. Never mind.
Okay, cool. We can just keep on going.
Bryce, you had a question as well about your second question. I remember that.
Was it the one about like task specific? Or oh, okay. So I think I was asking, I could imagine like a model component, like working on a bunch of tasks, right? So like it could, for example, I think we were reading about the IOI, like it could be serving as the name overhead, it could also in another task could be serving as something else. So I was just wondering, like, it's kind of impossible to like actually like first engineer like all the model components and like label them like universally. So is it like task specific all the time?
Yeah, so generally when I think of circuit, I think of them as task specific as well. that this is the circuit for this particular task. But the high level idea or high level hope of doing this kind of work is that probably someday we would be able to have modular circuits that is sort of universal across different kinds of tasks. We will find some smaller circuits which are modular, which you can basically find out in different kinds of tasks. I think that's the high level of hope.
Do you think that's possible, though?
I guess so. I think if we can scale things up, and this is just a GPT-2 small model, but let's say if we do similar kind of work in more than 100 billion model parameters, model, I feel we should be able to find some set of like smaller modular circuits which is generalizable across tasks. I mean, in a sense, you can think of induction as a circuit as well, which we know is generalizable across bunch of tasks. But maybe induction is a little bit low level. So I'm hoping something which is a little bit more of a higher level than induction, which would still make sense to people, but and is also found across models. Okay, so that was the definition of the circuit, but I'll raise one alert here. A lot of people, when they're talking about circuit, they use the term like mechanism and circuit sort of interchangeably. Now, when I say circuit, I really mean set of model components. But certain people, when they say circuit, they actually mean the mechanism. Like you can actually explain in English language how an input is getting transferred to the final output. Like you can explain what is the functionality of the model components, which I call mechanism. That's how generally I like to think, and I say set of model components as circuit, and that's what I will be using when I say circuit. Okay, so let's get into our first paper, the IOI paper. So I remember this was the 2022 paper. This came out during our first year in PhD. This was my first semester, actually. I'm super surprised by this work. It's very thorough work. And the other reason for me getting surprised was the first author. Yeah, you know the reason. So the first author, he was a high schooler at the time. And he's actually from Boston. I'm not gonna say where in Boston, but yeah, I'm super surprised to see that somebody in high school can do this kind of research, this kind of such a thorough, high-level research. So I was super surprised by that. And that's like a motivation for sort of all of us. You can do impactful, great research nowhere where you are. Yeah, I just wanted to say that. Okay, so coming to their experimental setup, that's pretty simple task. Yeah, so they have sentences like John and Mary went to a store, John gave a drink to, and then like this next token after two should be Mary. So that's basically the indirect object identification task. They study GPT-2 small, which has like 12 layers and 12 attention nets in each layer. And the metric that they use is called logit difference, which basically means that you take the logit of like the first person minus the logit of the second person. That's logit difference. And the model, the GPT-2 can perform the task almost 99, like almost 100%. Okay, so the main contributions, like I see this paper has two main contributions. One is the empirical contribution, which is the circuit itself. The other one is the methodological contribution, which is called path patching, which is important to understand how they actually came up with the circuit itself. So I'll first gonna describe the path patching algorithm intuitively, and then we will get into the details. So yeah, again, think of a neural network as a computational graph. Essentially, that's the question that path patching is trying to answer. So given this computational graph, what are the important edges in that computational graph which are causally relevant for doing a particular task? So what you do is you first need to come up with a counterfactual. And the kind of counterfactual that you come up is something which has completely different information about the, like, it should have different concepts which are relevant to your task. So it should still have similar structure, but the main thing that you're trying to understand should be different. So for this particular task in specific, let's assume this is our clean example. Then they basically used a corrupted version of this task, which would have three persons. And yeah, they basically use a three-person task where you will have person like John and Mary went to the store, then you will have Eric gave a drink to. So this basically destroys the indirectness of the task. Like there is no connection between the third person and the second, first and the second person. Yeah, so that's the corrupted example that they used in this particular example. Okay, so once you have your corrupted example, you feed both the examples in your model. And then what you do is you start patching in the edges which are directly connected to the final output from the corrupted one to the clean one. Okay, and you do that for all the edges that are directly connected to the final output. Only the edges which are directly connected to the final output. You do that, and for each patch, you will see that final output changes a little bit. So you need to measure that. So in this paper, they are using larger difference. So let's say you use that. So after this iteration, you will have a set of scores for all the edges which are directly connected to the final output. And you use some threshold to filter out the irrelevant ones and only keep the ones which has high causal impact on the final output. That's how you get like the first set of edges in your circuit. Now, once you do that, you basically need to do the same process again, but now assuming, instead of assuming logic or the final output as your target node, you use the nodes which are identified in the previous iteration as your target node and do the process again and again until you reach the inputs. And at the end of the process, you will have something like this where you will have all the important edges which connects the inputs to the final outputs. Any questions? So that was the intuition. Now this is the actual algorithm. This is, I think, yeah, this is an important slide. If you understand this, life would be good. Okay. So here,
So Nikhil, I find the previous slide a little bit easier to read than this one. Just for whatever reason, it's just because the layout. So I just want to give people just a minute to ask questions about the previous slide or either one before you get into it.
What's the
Yeah, I think that's an empirical thing that you have to. I don't think so. There is any specific theory behind what should be the threshold that you should be using. It also depends on the metric that you use. In this paper, they use logit length. Sorry, not logit length, logit difference. But that's not all. That's also not universal. Yeah, so I think you have to do it empirically, figure that out empirically.
I probably missed this part, but how did they come up with the graph? Like, how did they come up with what is an engine?
Yeah, so what exactly is an edge and how do you patch one edge? Like, how do you take an edge and patch it to a cleaner? That's a question that I'll be answering in the next slide. But yeah, that's the main
So
question.
can you give a little idea? Like, so what's like the idea of what you're trying to do before you show how we do it? Like, what is it you're trying to do when you patch an edge? What would it mean?
Okay. Let's use this diagram. Let's say I want to understand how this head affects this particular head. So there is a direct edge. There is an edge from this particular H1 to this particular H1. And I want to patch that particular edge. I want to know its significance or relevance for this particular task. I think the essential idea here is you batch the output of your like the sender node, like the node which is having the inline formation, while keeping in everything else in between constant. You need to make sure that nothing really changes in between when you patch in the output of this particular head. And then you need to figure out, like, you basically need to cache in the input of this particular head.
So I like this. I think this is funny because there's this thing that philosophers sometimes say, which is like, what's the importance of a thing? And they say they use this phrase, all else being equal, which is usually just a mental experiment. I mean, it's usually impossible to keep all else being equal. You just usually have to reason through it. Like, what would happen if everything else was equal? But I think the funny thing about this experiment that Kevin Wang, Rowan Wang, proposed was he says, oh, you can physically keep everything else all equal. Like if you want to know how important the edge is, you like physically like pin down everything else. Anyway, that's sort of the way I think of it. I'll let Nikhil get into the details, but I think it's easy to get lost with all the details. But if you just kind of keep in mind what he's trying to do is he's trying to do like one of these all else being equal experiments.
Just to reiterate what I was saying, yeah, basically I want to see how does information from this particular head goes via the residual frame to this particular head. So I keep everything else, the output of all the components in between the same, and essentially see how does this particular head affect the input of this particular head via the residual frame. That's the, I think, main idea. In terms of actually how would you do it, again, we would have to come back to this particular figure, which is from their paper itself. I did not make it. Yeah, so here it is upside. So this is our input, this is our output. The red ones are on corrupted sample. Green ones are on the clean sample. And the goal here is to patch in the edge from this particular head to this particular head and this particular head. I don't know why is this one green. Okay, yeah, there. Okay. So idea here is to patch in the edge from this particular head to this particular head and this particular head to this particular head. Okay. So what they do is they again feed in the clean sample. Okay. But now they patch in the output of this particular head from the corrupted one while keeping the output of all other heads the same as the original one. Okay. You can imagine the output of MLPs from the green one as well for now. If you assume that, then the red one, there would be only one path from this particular red to this particular head, which would be via the residual frame. Right, and essentially that's what they are interested in. They are like, we are interested in try to patch in the direct edge between these two particular heads. Okay, so in this step what we do is we patch in the output of this particular head while keeping the output of all attention heads fixed. You can also keep the output of MLPs fixed and then cache in the input of your receiver heads, which in this case is 2.0 and 3.1. Okay. Cache in the input of these two heads. Then comes the fourth step, where again you feed in the clean example. But this time you patch in the input of your receiver heads, which you cached in the previous step. And then you see what is the effect on the parallel. And that is equivalent to patching a direct edge between your receiver, your sender, and the receiver heads. Yeah, I think that's very confusing. I know that. So ask questions. The third step, I think, is the main one. Does that make sense?
Unless they're in the edges now, so any,
Okay.
The same as green one
Yeah,
or
so in terms of notation, green one is what you get from the second run, red one is what you get from the first one, and the black ones are recomputed one. The model just recompares. Okay.
can you repeat the word?
Yeah, so
Recompute.
yeah, the model just does the forward pass.
Oh.
You don't pass it. It just does the matrix manipulation.
So why the only path is
Assuming this is also green, if this was green, this wouldn't be red. Okay, because we are just patching. So in that case, the red would only come via the residual stream to this particular. Okay, that's essentially the idea. But if you in this, at least the work that they have presented in the paper, they have not kept the MLPs constant. They have not passed in the MLPs from the green one. They have let the MLPs become. Make sense?
Isn't there a forward, like after you've patched it, you're letting it like there's a forward pass amount, like the MLP also being computed then?
Yeah, it does.
So then won't that MLP zero also be like yellow or red? Because you're
So the MLPs will have a new value.
yeah.
That's what the black ones are representing. I don't know why this one is red. Why is this one red? I'm not sure why this edge is red. I think they should have been black as well. I think is it because if 0.1 is corrupted, that will be computed inside MLP zero, and the output of MLP zero will be corrupted or changed due to
But then this.
MLP.
Yeah, okay, Nagin. Okay, so in that case, this two edges should have been red as well. But I think what they're trying to say is okay, now I think it makes sense. This should have been red, but because you are patching this particular head, this particular path is basically blocked. That's why they did not make it red. But whereas this particular path is still red because of the residual swing. Make sense? No? No. Okay. Question was, why are we not patching MLP? Or the question was,
Why is residual 1.0 and 1.1 not changing into the forward pass? Like if you're corrupting 0.1 and then there is another forward pass you're recomputing, so shouldn't like the anything that's downstream also change?
which component do you think should change?
Like I would imagine 1.0 and 1.1 also change.
Yeah, it will change, but since we are patching in the output of those two heads from our clean samples, we are basically making sure that it does not change. Okay, we are basically blocking it. We are not letting it recompute. We are just putting in the value that it already had.
Then how can you guarantee like that it will be the same? Like I understand if you're just patching very good anything.
Yeah, it's a bit tricky. Yeah, I can see my questions. I mean, now that I kind of think this a little bit more like high level, like why do you care about the direct effect when you keep the other thing constant? Because I would imagine, oh, what this head does is it tells this other one to say this message. Like the full message is the full message. Why you care about the direct plan?
Yeah, because of the way they are trying to find the subtle. You remember the initial idea that I mentioned? You need to start from the end, then find the first set of heads which are directly affecting the fan-out. You don't want to care about anything in between. You want to just understand the effect of some set of upstream nodes to one specific downstream node. Once you figure that out, then you need to figure out what is the other set of upstream nodes which are affecting the set of nodes that you figured out in the first step. You don't want
So it's because if it doesn't affect you directly, then it's not the next step in the
Yeah,
staircase.
exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
Any more questions?
And this is a bit tricky. That's why I said this is probably important. And this is, yeah.
How do you connect this to the slide? So previously, find software for circuit addies, right? But in the lab, in the figure in the paper, they specifically choose some add or some circuit to do the experiment. So I'm just wondering, what's the connection between your two slides?
So the main connection is about how do you actually do this edge patching. You can easily do like node patching, like you just take the output of a particular node or a neuron and take patch it from one particular node to the other. That's easy. But the difficult one is how do you do the edge patching, which is what I'm showing you need to do to follow this path patching procedure. But in terms of actually implementing it is what they are trying to say in this figure. If you actually need to take a particular edge that you want to patch, these are the four steps you need to do to actually do it. That's it.
So I'll share a little perspective on it. This path patching thing is a little funny. It's a, you know, it's this idea of, you know, that it's this hope. It, you know, the circuit idea and the path patching idea, I think it chases this hope that we might be able to trace causal chains inside these neural networks the same way you might chase like a mystery or chase a you know, chase like a bug in a computer, a regular traditional computer program. You know, imagine like you're like a time traveler, right? And you want to like, I don't know, prevent World War II or something. Then you might go back in time and you might realize, aha, if I go back to a certain coffee shop and I just move this cup of coffee from one side of the table to the other, then it turns out that it has this all these follow-on effects, and it ends up, you know, preventing World War II is amazing, like a time travel movie, right? Well, that might be the case, but then you wonder, like, how did that happen, right? There's a lot of steps from here to there, and I think that like traditional patching, like what you guys have been doing for your experiments so far, is like that coffee cup experiment. It's like you might get a very strong signal on moving that coffee cup from one side of the table to the other. It's like, oh, yes, this coffee cup turns out very important for World War II. But it doesn't really tell you like how it's, you know, how it had an impact. And so it might be a little dissatisfying. And so really what you might want to know is the detailed causal chain. It's like, oh, if you move that coffee cup, then the immediate thing that happens is that you know, somebody in that store can't you know, can't pay for the coffee or something like that, or didn't, you know, can't find the coffee, and fell asleep, you know, in the afternoon, and then because they fell asleep, they missed a meeting, and because they missed a meeting, some conference wasn't organized, and because the conference didn't happen, you know, some other idea didn't happen in the culture, and this thing wasn't invented, and you know, had all these other effects, right? So you could kind of imagine this long causal chain. And traditional patching doesn't concern itself with the details of the causal chain. It just says, hey, this is important. It has some downstream effect. You know, you might wonder what that is, but you can just see that it has the effect. Whereas what path patching is trying to do is it's trying to say, well, you know, we're going to try to figure out what effect it has to move this little cup of coffee, this little red 0.1, and see. You know, what's the effect of that? Well, if you just patch that by itself and you let everything else move, it might have some big downstream effect, right? But what they're asking is, they're asking, you know, why did it have the downstream effect? So let's say there's somebody who misses. So let's say 0.1 is like the cup of coffee. What 2.0 and 3.1 are like the person who fell asleep because they didn't get their coffee or something, right? Like oh, that's like the next downstream effect that you're trying to test. And so you're saying, okay, well, look, missing the coffee copy messed up a lot of things in the world. It means that the person who's cleaning up the table now has to wipe the table in a different way. It means that the dishwasher cleans up the coffee in a different way. You know, now there's it's a full cup. Somebody didn't drink it. You know, they made a dollar less profit in the store, and that has some other effects and so on. But and so those are all the other green boxes. It would normally be downstream of 0.1. And what they're saying is, they're saying, hey, you know what? I suspect None of those really matter. What if we move the cup of coffee, but we don't allow us to see the changes that are downstream of the cup of coffee, other than the things that we think are the decisive ones? So fix the profit of the store. That's 1.1. Even though the store made one less dollar, restore them to have the extra dollar for free, right? Fix the dishwasher experience. That's 1.0. Yeah, even though the coffee was full, change the dishwasher experience a little bit. Yeah, pretend it didn't change at all. That's 1.0. Go to all the things and pretend that they didn't have an effect. The only thing that you're going to allow to have the effect is like 2.0, 3.1, right? Like just let the effects come through only to these new things, only the specific things. That's the attempt. It's asking this. It's asking, a more, like, if everything else was the same kind of experiment. And anyway, that's what it's attempting to do, to try to make it a little bit more satisfying. I don't know if that helps at all, but I always found it a little confusing, all the setup. This is the way I think of it. Does that make any sense? Anyway, I'll shut up again. Sorry, it's hard to lecture from remote.
Okay, yeah, I think you have a question.
Yeah, why do we start from the end and not from the beginning? Like in the coffee cup experiment, that was like starting from the beginning and looking forward, but this would be starting from, I guess, World War II and then slowly move backwards to get back to the coffee cup. Like why do we do it that way as opposed to start from the inputs and then patch forward?
Yeah, so I think it's because, let's say, if you start by trying to figuring out what is the most important edges at the beginning, while you don't really have anything, you don't really know which are the important set of nodes in your first layer. I think the way, at least path patching works, you need to know what is the important downstream nodes in your computational graph that you care about. If you don't know that, I don't know how would you do that. Yeah, so I think that's just how the framework is. Yeah, that's what I want to say.
I wonder if you could do it. It just would be less efficient. Like if you only know if the outcome be changed by some edge at the end. And if most of them don't have any impact, then you don't need to push down those. Is that right?
Okay, so
Like you have, if the output is going to change, there has to be, like, you know that something needs to change at the end.
yeah.
And so if you're like, oh, look, like most of those nodes don't, like those edges don't impact anything, then I don't need to look, I don't need to search down those edges. Is that
Yeah, but you still need to start from there.
right? And I'm saying, like, if you start from the end, then you can eliminate you, it's
Yeah.
just more efficient. Not that you
Yeah.
can't do it both ways, it's just that it's more.
It should be definitely efficient, and I'm still not sure how would you be able to do that from the start.
You could like just do the proof. You could just like brute force seven
So
to.
let's say this is your input. Let's say all of them is your output. And then you find some edge which has high. Yeah, what would that even be?
Yeah,
You
I
need
feel
to
like,
find. Yeah.
yeah, I just like, you could just do every single one, just every single edge. You could look at every single
There
node
might
based
be
on graph. It's just like,
there might be something that you have not
it's,
seen.
I'm not saying it's a fit, like, possible, like, would be tractable in any way, but.
And I'm not sure if it's intractable. So yeah, let's say maybe it is. You had a question.
Yeah, just going on what in my mind the analogy would be okay, you move the coffee cup and then that affects like 10,000 different things, and each of those things affects like 10,000 others, which would be like an infinite, in that case, untractable search. In a neural network, technically it's finite, so it's not infinite. But it would make much more sense to say, well, actually, if someone missed this meeting, then that would have avoided World War II. And if like this bus was late, then this meeting would be avoided, and then you're kind of searching in a tractable way. I think, yeah, I think your approach would be technically tractable, just because it's you have a finite amount of things, but it could be still like combinatorial.
Yeah, that's a good analogy.
I mean, it's already expensive.
It makes sense.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah.
Okay, so we have spent 45 minutes, so I think we can. So essentially, that's the path matching algorithm, and they use this particular algorithm to figure out the circuit for the IOI task. So as I stated earlier, they start with the end. They try to understand what are the gates which are directly affecting the final logic. They apply the path matching algorithm, and these are the red ones are basically the most important ones. Yeah, these are the first set of hits that they find with the path matching. They also try to understand the functionality of this head, which I'm not talking a lot about right now. I have a few slides at the end. But essentially, what they found was that these are the heads which are attending to the marry token and fetching its value. That's why they call it name overheads. Then the question becomes, okay, these are the heads which are fetching in the marry token. What are the next set of heads which are actually affecting those heads? Like, how does the name overheads know that it needs to attend to marry token? So for that, what they do is they apply the path matching algorithm. But in this case, the target node is basically the query vectors of the name overheads. And then the sender nodes are basically each of the nodes in the previous layers of the path. Any guesses why query not key or value? The idea here is to find out where or how does the name overheads know to attend to marry token. The way attention works is it is the query vector of attention head which encodes the information what it needs to attend to. And the key vectors encodes what is it actually encoding. And we know that the attention heads attend to the marry token. That's why the key vector at the last token doesn't really matter. And the value vectors, we already know that it is fetching in the values from the marry token. So that's like the other way to think about it. Yeah, so that's basically the next step. Using this particular step, they found our next set of attention heads. Again, they tried to understand the functionality of this head, and what they figured out was these are the heads which are sending in information about the John token to the name overhead, which is what the name overhead is using to not attend to John. And that's why they are calling this particular set of heads as S inhibition heads. Yeah, the functionalities are not very important. I'm gonna talk a little bit about the functionalities at the end, but I'm just trying to show you how you can apply path matching algorithm to find the set of heads in each step to find the overall sum. And they continue the same step again and again till they actually reach the input, and this is the overall circuit that they found. Okay, now we will take question. I think we'll start with Hayu. Yeah, the retraining impact. Who is Hayu? You know Hayu? Sorry. Hayu, if that's correct pronunciation, are you on the Zoom? Maybe he's not. So the question was, if we retrain GPT-2 from scratch, will we get same set of heads or not? That was first.
You'll need to unlock your iPhone.
That was the first part of the question. The second part, will the functionalities of those heads will remain same or not? What do you guys think?
Attention bits will change.
Okay.
Depending on the data that we train it on,
Let's say it's the same data. Exactly same data.
If there's stochasticity within the training, that could affect its changes slightly, but could be.
Okay. What about functionality?
Functionality should remain same, I think.
Any other guesses?
I think at the beginning you said that you expect some circuits to be modular and present in a lot of different networks. So you would expect, like, functionally some heads or circuits to be present in the same network on refrain, maybe in another place because it's on the old spot.
Yeah, so this is what I would expect, although I've not done the experiment. I think the exact heads would change because just because of random initialization. I think the initialization would be different. So even if training data is the same, I am quite confident that the heads won't be the same.
You don't think so?
But yeah, I've not done the experiment, but I feel because of the random initialization, I feel the heads should be different. But the functionality should remain the same since we are training on the same data. So I feel that at least the mechanism of how the model will solve the task should remain the same. Okay, now a few other questions. Arya, Ananya, and Jessica. Yeah, I think all three of you had like a similar kind of question about the generalizability of the result across different kinds of tasks. You wanna state that?
Yeah. I guess to me, it was like, how useful is this? Like, for example, in this paper, they looked like this particular example. If instead of having Mary, George, John, we had like three names, how is this? Yeah, basically, I understand the usefulness of path patching algorithm. I think that's, I feel like that's a useful contribution. But looking, what's the use of looking at this as a circuit? Because you have like a million circuits for different tasks and different data. Yeah, I guess that was.
Yeah, okay.
Arya? It's
essentially. Okay. Yeah, so I think I see similarly. I think, as I said, I think this paper has two main contributions, the empirical circuit and the method. I think the method is more important. Circuit is there. They found some set of heads and the functionality. But yeah, I don't think so. It's super general. I mean, that in itself is gonna have a huge impact in terms of how you think about it. But again, you have to think that you have to think about it in the context. This was 2022. This was probably the first paper which figured out the circuit in an end-to-end fashion. So from that perspective, I think that was pretty phenomenal. Okay, let's go ahead.
Wait, sorry. Could I? My question was like a little bit different. I had just asked about here it's like there's Mary and John, there's two like people, and so I was wondering what would we expect to see if there were more than two.
Yeah, I think in that setting, what I would expect is something more like entity tracking paper that we have. It's like this is again my expectation that the model would probably use the positional information or the ordering ID information of each of the person to basically figure out like different attributes about that particular person, depending on what you ask about that person. But I think primarily it will still use those positional or the ordering ID information to answer questions about that particular person. Is that helpful?
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, Avery, Christopher, and Rice, you guys had generalizability across models kind of question.
Yeah, it was kind of the same as like Tony's question about retraining. Like if we were to retrain GPT-2 or if we were to do this analysis on other models, like do we see similar-ish circuits? Like are there as in heads that feed into name movers, et cetera, or is it just totally different based off different models?
Yeah, so this is another paper which was not in the reading list. This is from Jack. So essentially in this work, what they did was they tried to study this IOI task in like larger GPT-2 models, like the medium and I think large. And I think what they showed was the mechanism remains more or less the same. The models are still using those NF. I mean, not the exactly same heads, but the way the model is solving the task remains the same. And another main result of this paper is if you look at the significance of those particular heads in different tasks. So I think they studied one another task called colored object, something like this object is of this color, this object is of this color. What is the color of this object? If you have this kind of question, then the heads that like the previous work found for the IUI task is actually being reused for this particular task as well. So the same set of heads are being reused for different kinds of tasks. Yeah, that's what I wanted to say.
Can you identify these circuits without knowing the architecture of the model? Say we have like access to some new Claude model and we have body.
You would need at least gradients. If not, if you can't do patching, you still need gradients. Yeah, you would still need internal activations or.
Like I meant for like you don't know what the architect like we know the architecture of GPT with how many layers are there. See, we get access to the how it's possible if you get access to the internal activation, but can that help like to backtrack the architecture? So if you have internal activations, can you construct the architecture?
Yeah, I think once you have the activation, you basically have the.
What about the GPT OSS open source models? So like we have the model base, but we don't know the exact architecture.
In this fashion. You don't know the architecture, but you have the weights.
Yes, we have the model base, but they are not disclosed model architecture.
Yeah, I think I should need to work on OSS. I've not worked on. How is that possible? If you know the weights, you basically know the architecture, right?
I am not 100% sure of that.
Maybe
You don't know
they
the
flattened
fully
it or something.
They flattened it? Then how do you work with that?
I'll talk with you about it later.
Yeah, okay, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Because you basically know the weights of the dimensions of the matrix. Every matrix.
Yeah, that's true. But yeah, there are still models to that.
Okay, maybe I can figure out. Yeah, one another thing is, yeah, so I said the first set of or the final set of heads which affect the final logic are called name mover heads. An interesting thing that this paper found was if you have laid out those name mover heads, the model's performance on this particular task does not really decrease. What really happens is some other set of heads comes into the picture, which are not really causally active in the normal state. But when you have laid out the name mover heads, this new set of heads comes into the picture, which they are calling as backup name mover heads. I think Claire had a good, like an insightful comment. Claire? Do you remember your comment? I think it was insightful. I didn't know about it. It was about neuroscience.
Redundancy. Redundancy, yes. There's a theory in neuroscience that the reason why it's so hard to find neurodegenerative diseases because the brain is really good at having redundant pathways for the same task. And so there could be like in a circuit that level of the same redundancy, I thought.
Yeah, cool. That was insightful. I didn't know about how does the human brain works. So I just wanted to bring out that point to show there might be some analysis between what we are doing quite clearly. Okay, so we have found the circuit, but that's not the end of the game. We have to evaluate the circuit, but to actually show that we have found something genuine. And the paper proposes three metrics. Criteria. The first one is called faithfulness. It's, I think, the easiest one to understand. You basically ask this question: is the identified circuit faithful to the underlying model? Can I get the performance of the model just from the circuit itself? And that's basically the metric. You compute the final output, like the final performance of the circuit, and just divide it by the performance of the model. And when I say performance of the circuit, what do I mean is I basically you basically ablate out everything else which is not part of the circuit. You keep the circuit components intact, but you ablate out all the model components which are not part of the circuit, and then check the final output. Yes, yeah, so in this work, the circuit that they have found has about 87% of faithfulness. Yeah, Yuki had a question about implementation. Yuki, are you online? Maybe not, but I think it's the simplest. You just ablate out all the model components which are not part of the circuit, get the performance, and just divide it by the model performance. The next one is a little bit tricky. It's called completeness. So the question here is, okay, we found the circuit, but how do we know that we have found all the components of the circuit? Is it complete or we are still missing out something? Yeah, so the basic idea here is if you assume this is the underlying circuit where you have like two redundant components, like sort of like redundant sub-circuits, which are getting an OR operation, which are combined with an OR operation here before the final output, you would get complete faithfulness even if you find just one of them. But that's not what we want. We want to find both C1 and C2. That's basically the idea here. And this is the equation to find the or to get that incompleteness score. What this equation means is K is some subset of the circuit components. Okay. T is the circuit, M is the model. So you compute the circuit performance by ablating out. Right. A sub subtracted by the performance of the model when you ablate out that particular same subset. The idea here is the difference between these two should be minimum if the model is complete. They should have the same impact. So, for instance, if C is only C2 and K is, let's say, C. So K is C2 as well. So if you ablate out this thing completely and you check the performance of that particular circuit, you'll still get complete performance. Right?
Wait, Nikhil, I have a question. Like, how much of this is specific to like circuits formed? I'm so sorry. Using backpropagation? Like, is that like one of the assumptions we're making here?
I think we are talking about like neural, like normal neural networks, which are trained from backpropagation.
Okay. So, like, if we use a different, like, updating, like mechanism, like, this isn't necessarily true.
I think you'll still be able to apply this method. Not really seen anyone not using backpropagation.
Yeah, Jasmine, did you have another update mechanism in mind?
Like I was thinking of like maybe like Hebbian learning or something, like where you're using the coactivations or yeah, I think that was the one of the ones I was thinking of.
Yeah, I think that probably not a lot is known because so much of so much of the field is just for the last whole bunch of years, decade and a half has all been backpropagation. So it might be that the question you have has a different answer, but I think that people might not know.
Okay, thanks everyone.
Okay, so we were talking about this thing, completeness code. Give me 1 minute. David, do you remember this one?
What's the question?
Did you basically remember this particular criteria the company has one and why does this particular question make sense?
Oh, the completeness and incompleteness score, like how to justify why you would score it this way? Is that what you're asking? If I'm being perfectly honest, no, I don't totally remember why we why it was proposed to do it this way. I think that the intuition that you gave is the right one, which is basically you're asking the question, once you have a circuit, it's the same question that you would have if you if somebody published a paper saying, "Hey, you know what? I know what caused World War II. It's this coffee cup." And then the whole downstream chain of events that come from this. And then people would say, "Well, I don't believe it. I think that there's some other path, a causal chain that also explains World War II." And I think that your coffee cup is theory is only a partial explanation for the whole thing. There's 11 other, key variables that are involved. They all have to be involved. And so I think that this idea is trying to capture the idea that if you tried to form the circuit in any other way, if you had a complete circuit, then no matter what you removed, it would make the explanation worse.
Yeah,
But
I got it. So the rationale here is this C vent K is removed.
I think they're saying, like, if you say the circuit for this task is C1, so if C equals C1, and if you set K to C1 as well, it will have a low incompleteness score, or like a high incompleteness score. So
For what?
C can, because C slash C1 will be, we will have like zero, right? Because it cannot complete the task. But the second one, M slash C1, it would still complete the task. Because you have C2, so you
Yeah,
have a high incompleteness score. So that means you can't set C to C1. It's an incomplete circuit.
and the reason why C when K is set to C1 would be basically this metric would be low is because
You have
when
nothing
you are
else. You have nothing else, right?
yeah exactly so you're basically updating out entire model here assuming this C1 and C2 are the only components in the model. And when you're computing the performance of the circuit, what you do is you only keep the components of the circuit intact while updating out everything else. Okay? So assume that K was not here and the C was C1. Okay? So what would that mean is we are only keeping C1 active and C2 would be completely read off. Okay? But now let's say K is C1 as well. K is C1. So now in addition to updating out C2, C1 will be updated out as well. So there is nothing in the model. So the model performance will be almost zero. Okay? Got it? But for M, for the second term, we are only updating out C1 with or whatever circuit that you decide, whatever C that you decide to be the circuit. Whether C1 or C2. Assume it is C1. So we will only update out C1 while the C2 still remains intact. So that's why the model performance will still be high. That's why their absolute difference will still be high. And therefore, we can say that whatever circuit that we decided or whatever circuit that we have found is actually incomplete. Does that make sense? Or do you want me to repeat again?
Repeat again, who's C and who's M?
C is the circuit that you identified. K, sorry, and M is the model. Okay. And you find F of C by keeping the model, like the components in C intact while updating out everything else. And what this is saying is, in addition to updating out everything else, you update out that subset of C components, which is k as well. And okay, so that was completeness. Now this is the third one, which is minimality. So you can have a very big circuit. Assume your entire model is a circuit. Then you would have a very high faithful and a high completeness score for your circuit, but that's not what we want. We want the circuit to be something of a smaller order. We want it to be as minimal as possible. So that's the criteria. So that's the third criteria that we use to evaluate our model. This is, I think, even more trickier. So what you do is, in this particular, this is again the equation to find the minimality score for each particular component in your circuit. And assume that particular component is V. What you do is you remove some subset K along with that particular component from the circuit and subtract it from just removing that subset from the circuit. Just to give you an example, let's say we are looking at one particular name over heads. And assume that the K is basically all the group of all the name over heads except that particular head that we are looking into. So what the first expression would mean is we are getting rid of all the name over heads. Yeah, basically we are getting rid of all name over heads. That's the first expression. The second expression is we are getting rid of all but that particular head in our name over group. And since we have found that that particular head is, let's say that particular head is causally relevant, that particular head will make the model get to the correct answer. And that's why the later term will have a higher score, while the previous one will have almost no score, no performance, because we have basically updated on all the name over heads. And that's why that particular component would be critical. It's like it is a critical component that you need to keep in the circuit. But if that particular score is not that high, that means that component is not really that critical. And that's basically what this minimality criteria is about. Okay, now I'm gonna go ahead. But any questions in that this particular previous paper? I'm now gonna go to the next paper. So we learned about path patching. We found the circuit of GPT-2, which is responsible for doing the IOI task, and then we evaluated the circuit on three particular criteria: faithfulness, completeness, and minimality. Even if you didn't get completeness and minimality, it's okay. As long as you got faithfulness, I think that's okay. Okay, now coming to the second paper. Yeah, I think, how do I pronounce it? Kyung? That's correct.
Yes, I'm here.
Are you online? Yeah, basically the question was, what should be the focus of mechanistic interpretability? Should we still focus on human-driven, or should we focus more on automated interpretability? So I'm in the favor of automated interpretability. I think you have seen the previous paper, how difficult that is. So it was so difficult to explain. Just assume how difficult that would be to do it. So nobody wants to do it. Everyone just wants an agent. You can just write a prompt to find a circuit, and the agent will give you the circuit. That's probably the ideal goal. So I'm very pro automated interpretability, but yeah, again, we are still not there yet. So we still need to find a few things manually, but hopefully a few years down the line, we have an agent which can do most. So yeah, in this paper, they basically talk about one particular step in the steps, like broadly speaking, steps that we took in the circuit discovery process. The first step was, and this is something that we have recommended for this class as well. Come up with a particular task, come up with a particular data set and the metrics and the model which can do it. Then you need to decide the level of analysis that you want to perform, whether you want to work on layers, neurons, heads, or maybe subspace level. So once you have decided, once you have done the step two, you basically have the computational graph. Now you need to tune out that computational graph to figure out the subgroup. That's the third step. So this particular paper basically automates that third step. The algorithm is pretty straightforward, so that's why I've just pasted in the algorithm itself. What you do is, once you have that computational graph, you topologically sort it in the reverse order. So you still start from the end. Let's say you're still starting from the logit, and then you look at each of the edges which are directly connecting with the final logit. What you do is, for each of those edge, you basically remove it from the computational graph and see if the final output changes significantly or not. If the final output changes more than a particular threshold, you may, or that basically means that that particular head is important for doing this particular task. So you keep that edge in the circuit, and you basically do the same process again and again. And each time you keep a like edge, you basically add that part, like its node or its parent node as part of your queue, and then you do the same process again and again. It's basically like breadth first search, but the criteria for keeping an edge in the circuit or not is basically defined by the threshold value. Is that clear?
And it's the same for every layer.
The threshold?
Yeah.
I think, at least in the paper, they have not used dynamic. They have used a concept. Yeah, it's pretty straightforward. So this is the algorithm. So they evaluated, or they basically found out the circuit for a bunch of tasks, including the IOI task and a few other tasks. And they basically use the ROC curve to show, to basically compare their proposed method ACDC with a few other methods, which are not super important. But I just wanted to put it here because I wanted to show you that they are evaluating it as an ROC curve, which basically means that they are assuming that there is a ground truth label. So what they did was, they basically went out and looked at the previous literature to figure out which are the previous works where circuits are already available. They use their method to find out the circuit for the same task, and they basically compared those two circuits to come up with this ROC curve. Courtney had a question. How do you get the ground truth? Is that clear?
Yeah, how do you know that something is the ground truth
It's
circuit?
basically coming from the literature. You assume that whatever previous published work is there is correct. But yeah, again, there is caveat to that. Maybe even the published work is not exactly correct. I think even in the paper, in this one or the next one, I think there was a point I remember. There's just huge number of edges in the model. Even GPT-2 would have what? Yeah, it will have a lot of edges. So it is not unlikely that maybe even the researchers whose papers are published, they missed out on a few edges. So the ground, you need to take the ground truth with a pinch of salt as well. Okay, now I'm going to ask questions. Problems with ACDC. What kinds of problems do you see associated with this particular matter?
Is this going to be computation?
Yeah, that's right. It is very computational. It grows linearly with the number of edges in the model. So it is very computational.
I guess it would be like millions.
Other problems?
But
Why is that wrong?
that so in the previous course I had we see how minimal changes in the input of the like an ML simple ML impacts the output. And then at each layer the it will result in a larger amount. But in that case we were You can get the problem was making the spine balance tighter. But anyways, it would grow larger. So somehow from that intuition, I think thresholds should be different. I think for players.
Yeah, I think intuitively I agree with that. Maybe, but the way I would say that would be, is it at the end of the computational graph, since they are closer to the final output, they might have a higher effect on the final output. But that's why the impact for changing or perturbing those edges would be pretty higher in comparison to perturbing earlier layer edges. That's why maybe the threshold should be different.
Yeah, I agree with that. Although that's not on the board.
Slide, but I intuitively I agree with that. Any other issues? Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I guess if you do so many comparisons, you will find a lot of random significant results. So you will have a lot of spurious circuits that don't actually mean anything. You just found them because you did so many tests.
You've got to explain that a little bit. So, when you say so many circuits, Mike, what do you mean?
I mean, when you do statistical tests, if you do thousands of tests, if you collect, for example, thousands of people and test, I don't know, something, like in at least one of them, even though if there is no effect, you will find a correlation, significant correlation, because of the chance. So I feel like this is going to be the same problem since you sort of you look for any possible significant result, and a lot of them might be just there by chance.
I'm not sure where stochasticity would come into
Oh, I see.
this algorithm. It's pretty ridiculous.
But I do think that this is a reasonable form of a concern. So I don't want to dismiss it. I think this is one of the issues with these large-scale interpretability methods in general, the things that say scan over everything, test everything, and whether everything is like thousands of choices or millions of permutations or something like this, then you're definitely, even if it's not statistical in nature, right? Even if it's not about probabilities, whatever, you definitely have this situation where, well, you're if you look enough, you're going to find what you look for. And then you're left with this question: is that meaningful? Is it surprising? I think that the typical solution for that, if you use one of these methods in your paper, which I think is fine to use one of these interpretability me like automated interpretability methods, but the thing that you want to do is not just present it as saying, "Hey, I used a method and look, found this circuit, and here's the picture." You want to triangulate it. You want to say, okay, well, the circuit was proposed by this algorithm. It was found by this algorithm, but we don't totally trust it because it looked for so many millions of things, and who knows, right? It just found something. We brought some new data, some new tests to the question, and we validated that this circuit has causal effects, or it has the, or this circuit, tells us something about this new data that wasn't used in the original scan. I think that's the typical way that machine learning people try to avoid being fooled by these statistical traps is by increasing the data. And you'll see that machine learning people are usually less, they tend to be less careful about the careful statistical analysis that you see in a lot of like social science research, oddly enough, because they're supposed to be, the technical machine learning people. But I think the reason why is because they tend to, instead of solving the problem by making sure the error bars are just small enough or whatever, right? They just completely squash the error bars by bringing in 10 times more data or something like that, right? Oh, we found this using 1,000 sentences, and then we tested it on another 20,000 sentences or something, if you work through the error bars on these things, it usually solves the problem. And maybe unfortunate that a lot of the papers don't actually work through the error bars that carefully, but that's usually the solution. Does that sort of answer the question a little bit, from at least from a practical point of view?
Oh, maybe we can move on, but just I was thinking, would you expect this algorithm to find any circuits in a just initialized?
The initialized model, like randomly initialized model, wouldn't have behavioral performance.
It shouldn't, right? But you're like checking for all possible circuits.
What would be the threshold there? I mean, here in this particular, let's say the IOI example, we use logit difference. But the logit difference of and randomly initialized model wouldn't really be meaningful. You will find something, but yeah, it would be completely not.
Yeah, I was this is like a messy set of thoughts that was on the question of the limitations. Like sometimes people talk about causes in terms of like necessary and or sufficient. It's like what's a necessary cause, what's a sufficient cause, is a cause necessary and sufficient and not sufficient or deficient and not necessary. I think like those would capture necessary and sufficient causes. The redundancy network would be sufficient but not necessary. And then maybe there's some causes that are necessary but not sufficient. Like they, like two edges might be causally contributing when they're both activated, but when you go one by one, both will show up as not necessary. Or it is not causally contributing to the outcome. So I guess the question would be how does this method handle those sorts of situations, or does that tend to not arise?
I think it's a very valid point. I think it does not take in, like it does not solve the problem. It looks at each edge at a time. So if there are like three edges which are working combinedly, if you patch three of them combined, like all of them together, you see a certain effect on the final output. But if you patch only one of them to be low, that means you could be discarding all the three of them. In actuality, you should have kept all three of them. I think that's one of the limitations of this approach. Yeah, scalability is an issue. Again, the other negative like problem with AC/DC is it was unable to find out negative components, which are like the components that the IOI people showed that these are the components which negatively affect the performance. But these are causally relevant as well. And this particular algorithm cannot solve the task. And there was issue with the evaluation as well. Ground truth could be missing. I think those are the four main, and the few others that we talked about are the problems with this AC/DC paper. And yeah, I think I heard from somebody this 10 minutes is, I'm not sure, I've not tried it myself, but I think I heard from probably the first author that to get the IOI circuit on GPT-2, using this method would take about 10 minutes. So I guess you guys are working on 7 billion and 70 billion. So I think this is out of reach. I don't think so you can use AC/DC, but okay. Now coming to our final paper. And I think this paper solves all the problems that the previous paper had. So let's look at each of them one by one. So let's start with the scalability issue. I think Gabriel talked about attribution methods last week, and I think he did touch upon component attribution, but I'm still gonna repeat it just for completeness. So the main idea here is to use first order Taylor approximation to find the effect of a batch. So we basically use this particular equation to find what would be the significance or the causal effect of patching a particular edge inside the computational graph instead of actually doing the graph. What that means is we can find out the importance of a particular edge with just two forward passes and back to the pass because this particular equation just needs three terms. This Z prime U is basically the
sort of like the activation of that particular edge on the corrupt example. This one is the activation on the clean example. And this is the gradient of that particular edge with respect to the loss that we are considering. That means we just need two forward pass and one backward pass, irrespective of the model size. So this is constant time. This does not really grow with the number of edges in the model. So it is very efficient. But it has some problems. Empirically, it's not that well, and theoretically as well. In this particular slide, if you remember this equation, if our, let's say Z is on a flat plane, if the loss value of Z is near zero, what would that mean is the edge important would be almost equal to zero. But it might be the case that, okay, maybe the Z value is zero, but the Z prime value, which is the activation of the edge on the counterfactual or the corrupt example, is significant. So we don't want, so there's sort of a conflict between these two observe, like these two interpretation. While on some example it is saying that it is important, while on the other example it is saying it's not important. What we do is we basically interpolate between these two particular samples. So instead of taking in the activations from just the clean one and the corrupt one, we do an interpolation between them. Just draw a straight line and divide the straight line into n number of steps, and then use the activation at each of those steps to compute the gradients. So instead of one gradient number for each edge, you will have m number of gradients for each edge. Then you can combine those m gradients to find the importance of this edge. And this, theoretically as well, and empirically, this has been shown to be working much better than just using a single gradient. So this solves the scalability issue of ACDC. Actually, there was another problem with ACDC. The edges that you find may not be connected with each other. So you may find one edge which does not really have any edge connecting from it. So it might not be a connected graph itself. So there was a problem with ACDC. This paper solves it by using a specific way to get the graph. So the first step of this particular method is, okay, you apply edge attribution patching, you get a score for each edge in the computational graph. Now you need to use those weights or edge importance score to basically extract out the subgraph of this computational graph. And in the ACDC, what they do is they basically do sorting of the weights or sorting of the edges based on the weights, and they pick up the top and edges, which is why it could be disconnected. But in this particular paper, they do something more sophisticated, like they do a little bit more more than that. So they basically, what they use is a greedy approach. Again, they start with the logits, then for each of the parent, each of the node which is directly connected, on each of the edges which is directly connected to the logit, they compute the maximum score. They keep the maximum score edge, add it to the queue, and repeat the same process again till the queue becomes empty. It's almost like Dijkstra's algorithm, but instead of minimizing, you're maximizing it. Yeah. So this solves the disconnected components issue. And security, the absolute score, not really the positive ones only. We will also figure out the negative components as well, because the negative components absolute value will still be high. I think the last issue with that ACDC paper was the evaluation itself. It used ROC curve, which requires ground truth, which could be messy. So instead of doing that, this paper basically used faithfulness.
LS metrics that we studied in the experiment. We used that to evaluate the circuits that they found in the method. The exact results is not super important, I think, here. The main takeaways, yeah, the integrated gradient methods is working slightly better than the non-integrated one. But again, it is not very clean. It depends on task to task as well. Okay, so the faithfulness of the circuits identified by the integrated gradient method seems to be in general working better, although there were some edge cases. But the overlap between the circuits that was identified using the integrated gradients with the actual ground truth, the ground truth from the previous work, was actually low. This is what this figure is showing. I should have added the major paper. So the dotted ones are the overlapping score or the average overlap for the non-integrated gradient one, and the solid lines are for the integrated gradient one. As you can see, the dotted lines have higher overlap, especially for the larger number of components in the circuit. So these two are sort of like conflicting results. If you think about it, integrated gradient is giving you more faithful circuits, but it is not overlapping with the previous ground truth circuits.
Can you remind me of the faithfulness of the not integrated gradients circuits?
So this blue one should be the line. These are the six. These are the six transmitters. Except probably in the IUI for some numbers. In most of the other cases, the blue ones is below the orange. Yeah, so these are like two conflicting results. While faithfulness seems to be better for integrated gradients, overlap is not. So what should we do? Should we use, or should we use faithfulness, or should we use overlap to evaluate the circuits identified by a new method? Let's say you come up with some method. Yeah, maybe you try from the start instead of the end. You then probably somehow it works, and you want to evaluate that method. How would you evaluate it? Would you use overlap, or would you use faithfulness? People's thought. I'm gonna wait here for some time. What do you think? Overlap is better or faithfulness? I think that's an easy question. Yeah, why?
The ground truth is wrong.
Yeah, that is what it's. That can't be 100% sure about the ground truth, especially with the larger models. Ground truths could be messy. But the other reason why I think faithfulness is a little bit more faithful is because of the causal nature of it. Overlap is not really causal in nature, but faithfulness is. And I generally believe results which are more causal in nature. This is like a specific example here. So let's say you find this two particular circuit. This is a circuit from the new method. This is the circuit from the old method. Those are its configuration. The overlap will still be 50%, but the faithfulness would be zero. And that's why this 50% might be deceiving. That's why I would show more faithfulness.
I think my confusion is, like, even if you have, like, included wrong or something in your circuit, and so it's proving totally wrong stuff, but maybe it's, like, you did actually get, like, say you had ground truth and overlap, like, I feel like you could still do analysis on those components. You're just going to have to be, like, some of these might just be wrong, but we can generally characterize the kind of
Is that like, I think, I would say that I would show more faithfulness to faithfulness. But if you have ground truth, there is no harm in doing it. I mean, you can always compute overlap. It's a very cheap metric to compute. So, yeah, if you have the ground truth, you can just record both the numbers in the paper. Yeah, when possible, record both the measures. Yeah, I think that was their main takeaway, to not think too much about the overlap metrics, which is what the AC text people did, and to think more about the causality and the faithfulness metric. Okay, so all those four issues are solved. And now, are we good? Have we achieved our end goal? So we started with this question: can we reverse engineer neurons and their connections to understand the underlying algorithms? And this is something what we get from these kinds of circuit discovery methods. Is that what we want? Yeah, that's a question for you. It was not too hard.
I guess we still got to figure out what each part of the circuit actually does. Some things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we don't want that kind of network. Essentially, what we want is a more filling mechanism where you can actually explain it in the English language and what is actually going on inside the model, rather than just hit on this particular head and that particular head. Essentially, that's what we want. We want to find that underlying mechanism, not just a set of model components which are evolving in this particular path.
Question. Is that a hard task? Like, using that's a hard task, trying to, given you for GPT-2, you have for all possible tasks you have, or not all possible tasks, but for a substantial amount of tasks you have the circuits underlying. Do you think it's a hard task to be able to identify patterns on what the model is doing for
Yeah, I think it's difficult. The reason why it is difficult is because it is still not scalable. You still need to think about potential hypothesis for what these model components are actually doing. Come up with causal experiments to verify it. Or even if it's not causal, let's say correlation or observation, you still need to come up with a hypothesis and test it. That's a very tedious task. Even for GPT-2, I think I would do it. If you think that certainly for 7 billion, 7 billion, it would be very tedious. And there is no clear way to automate them, at least as of now. That's why it is a difficult task. But since it is difficult, I think that's the direction where the scope for contribution is also on. I think a lot of companies as well, like I think any company right now who is doing interpretability of MechIntub is devoting some of their resources to based on my knowledge. So I think it's one of the hot topics. Yeah, I think that was my last point. Finding circuit is just the starting. And essentially, you need to figure out the underlying mechanism. It's still a difficult task. Yeah, I think Tapan and Rice had a similar question, but I think, okay, but these are like more recent papers on circuit discovery. So if I were to find out circuits, just the model components today, I think I would implement path passing from the scratch. That would be too much just for the target. What I would do is I would probably go through the code bases of this papers. Try to see if I can get some circuit on the task that I care about. I would say the first paper, one advantage of that paper is you get circuit across token positions. So for both the AC/DC and the EAP-IG paper, they do not really find the circuit for different, they do not find the model components which are causally relevant for earlier tokens. They only look at the last token. But that's probably not the end of the picture. And if you want to look into the earlier tokens, the first paper actually does that. Let you do that. And these two papers are from Anthropic. I think this was the first paper where they tried they basically came up with their attribution graph on a replacement model, and their replacement model had something called transcoder, which is similar to SAEs but for MLPs. So they had this replacement model, and then they found out the graph of the circuit on that replacement model. And this particular new paper is basically a library on top of that that you can use for your project. But it does require you to have transcoder. This is the last paper from Transluce that I think I wanted to mention. They too use a replacement model, but they are not working on SAEs or transcoder space. They are still working on neuron spaces. So their replacement model actually get rid of all the non-linearity in the model, so that the attribution graph that you get is more accurate. Yeah, I think that's the main difference between this paper and the underlying ideas are pretty much the same.
Evaluate whether these are like reasonable or something like that. I guess
it's so graph. It's not like it's like, oh, they're all different in the same way. They're not all different.